In Israel today, in a time of war, President Biden spoke about peace.
We must keep pursuing peace. We must keep pursuing a path so that Israel and the Palestinian people can both live safely.
Israelis welcome Biden, even as many of them are heaping scorn on their own prime minister.
Netanyahu has just seemed to fade next to the American president.
Meantime, there's anger in Arab capitals over U.S. support for Israel and civilian casualties in Gaza. I'm Marco Werman. In other news, what do you get when you mash up Pokemon with Vincent van Gogh? One museum in Amsterdam found out the hard way. And in Argentina, an economist and presidential candidate with some extreme views is winning over frustrated voters.
Hola a todos!
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. It is a complex and dangerous moment in the Middle East, and that's where we begin, with two conversations about the latest. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Beirut, one of the Arab capitals, where news from Gaza is fueling anger and frustration as Palestinians in Gaza face unrelenting Israeli bombardment. But first, to Israel, a nation still awash in grief after the deadliest attack on its soil in generations. President Joe Biden made a historic visit to Tel Aviv today, reaffirming Washington's support.
Well, today, I say to all of Israel, the United States isn't going anywhere either. We're going to stand with you. We'll walk beside you in those dark days. And we'll walk beside you in the good days to come. And they will come.
Biden also announced $100 million in new U.S. aid for Gaza and the West Bank and said that Israel will now allow desperately needed aid into Gaza by way of Egypt.
Israel agreed the humanitarian assistance can begin to move from Egypt to Gaza.
The timing around when that aid might arrive remains unclear. Journalist Noga Tarnopolsky is in Jerusalem. Noga, how did Biden's trip go over today with Israelis?
The trip went over very, very well. Israelis are just entranced by Biden's ability to embrace them, to speak from the heart. It's a remarkable fact that the Prime Minister of Israel is himself the brother of a soldier who died in battle. He's not somebody unfamiliar with grief, but he hasn't found within himself the ability to express that sort of empathy and love to Israelis. And so most Israelis were really awash with that Biden empathy today. The highways all around the country had these huge banners saying, "Thank you, Joe Biden." There were some tones of critique from families of Israeli hostages who are very angry that the United States demanded Israel accede to humanitarian requests when they have gotten nothing from their hostages.
We'll get to the hostage in a moment, but also kind of connected to that, in his speech today in Tel Aviv, Biden cautioned Israelis, saying, "While you feel that rage, don't be consumed by it." What do you think he was getting at, and how is that sentiment received in Israel?
I think he was getting at a message that he has tried to transmit consistently to Israel since the attack on October 7th, which is, we're with you, we're not going anywhere, you have full American support. And at the same time, he says, you can't behave the way the terrorists do. We democracies have our rules.
How did Prime Minister Netanyahu react to Biden's comments?
Netanyahu has become, in a way, Israel's incredible shrinking prime minister. He's someone who has been such a massive presence on the Israeli scene for so long, and yet he just hasn't seemed able to muster the presence necessary for this event. So the truth is, he expressed only gratitude towards Biden during the visit and after the visit, but mostly he has been muted. And there were just incredible scenes this afternoon of Biden meeting with survivors of the attacks and people who lost family members, most notably a guy who I think is an American citizen as well, this tech executive, Eyal Waldman, whose daughter was killed. He postponed the visit to traditional visit to his daughter's grave so as to meet Biden. And Netanyahu has just seemed to fade next to the American president.
Well, one thing that is front and center for many Israelis, obviously still, the estimated 200 hostages Hamas is thought to be holding. The families of those kidnapped victims are in anguish and are also increasingly vocal. Here's Rachel Goldberg on Sky News. She's the mother of Hirsch Goldberg-Polin.
I don't know if he's alive. I don't know if he died yesterday. I don't know anything. So the knock might come on my door at any time.
Noga, we've also seen videos of protesters and families of hostages outside Israel's Ministry of Defense, some demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Netanyahu. What's going on there?
Netanyahu has not met with the public even once in these 12 days of war. And after getting really blistering criticism over this, about, I think it was 3 days ago, he agreed to meet five families of hostages who were very carefully chosen. And these people were very grateful. They went to meet him in a secure location of the prime minister. The entire event was very managed. And then to their shock, in the middle of this meeting, they finally got with the prime minister. A bearded guy shows up, presents himself as if he were just like walking by in the secure location. He presents himself as the relative of a 12-year-old hostage. And he stands in front of the prime minister and starts heaping him with praise and saying that he's willing to make the ultimate sacrifice so that Israel can execute this war. The families were completely baffled. And then what was revealed in Israeli media yesterday is that this entire farce was engineered by Netanyahu's office or Netanyahu's close advisors. The gentleman who had shown up he's an extremist activist and the head of an organization that has supported Netanyahu, and he has nothing to do with any hostage.
Noga, are you able to characterize how Israelis are reacting to the daily airstrikes on Gaza and the demand for humanitarian assistance for Palestinians there?
I think that Israelis feel that their pain is not being heard by those voices in the international arena that keep issuing kind of alarm bells about the humanitarian situation in Gaza. And there are, of course, some politicians and even some parents of hostages who have spoken out, who have said that they feel the same pain that Gazan parents feel. But by and large, I would have to say that Israel still is so engulfed in shock and grief that they're not really registering the concerns about Gazan civilians except for as criticism of Israel.
Journalist Noga Tarnopolsky in Jerusalem, thank you very much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
When the news broke last night about hundreds of Palestinians killed at a hospital, anger erupted across the region. In Ramallah, the de facto capital for the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, protesters took to the streets and chanted for the downfall of President Mahmoud Abbas. And in Amman, the Jordanian capital, demonstrators gathered outside the U.S. and Israeli embassies. There were also protests in Egypt, Libya, and in Lebanon. Reporter Rebecca Collard is in Beirut and spoke with protesters near the U.S. embassy there today. Rebecca, what did you see and what did you hear from people out in the streets?
Yeah, so first of all, Marco, to your point, there was this spontaneous eruption of protests also here in Lebanon last night, including in front of the U.S. embassy. And then we had Hezbollah call for an unprecedented day of anger. So really protests here today in Beirut. So we had several protests organized. I went to the one in front of the American embassy. Thousands of people showed up there. There were Palestinian flags, Hezbollah flags, and really the flags of a lot of different factions here in Lebanon, and people were really angry. Protesters I talked to, a lot of them made it clear they were not there because of Hezbollah's call for protest. They were there because they were angry about what's been happening in Gaza, and I think that anger has really been building over the last 10 days or so, and it really boiled over last night. But let's listen to what one protester had to say.
And why the American embassy?
Because they call always from the human rights and they don't do anything upon it. So as a humans, we're here. It's not the religious, it's not anything politics or something. We're here for the humans, for the Palestinian people.
All right, so that's in Beirut. But as we know, there were protests also in Cairo, in Tripoli, in Libya, in Amman. So turning back to the wider region, Why are we seeing protests in all these Arab countries?
Well, I think because of the same thing that's happening here in Lebanon. People's anger has really been building over the last 10 days. They have seen, you know, these strikes on Gaza. They have seen this high civilian death toll. And then you had this bubbling over of anger last night. You know, I'll just say one other thing about the protest here in Lebanon, which I think is really important. You know, it's important to remember that there is no Israeli embassy here. There is no Israeli institutions here. There is no Israeli presence at all because Lebanon and Israel do not have any diplomatic relations. So, you know, also when I was talking to people here in Lebanon today, they were saying that the reason they're going to the American embassy is because, of course, America is the political and military backer of Israel. So I think that that's an important point. But, you know, I spoke with Dana El-Kurd. She's a senior non-resident fellow at the Arab Center in Washington. And she made a point about what we are seeing in the streets of the Arab world really for the last decade and what we're hearing from Arab governments.
There is a broader public support, you know, sentiment of outrage across these different countries. There's protests also because some of this is attributed to the fact that people are really fed up with their own governments, that they feel that they don't represent them, that their foreign policy does not reflect their positions and their priorities. They feel that their governments are complicit. We see this especially in countries where governments have recently signed normalization deals with Israel. So they feel that their governments are complicit in providing cover to an Israeli attack on Palestinians. And that's why we're seeing the scale of the protests.
Rebecca, after the hospital explosion, President Biden's planned summit today with Arab leaders from Egypt, Jordan, and the Palestinian Authority was abruptly canceled. What do we know about why it was called off?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, the anger in the streets, and I think El-Kurd's point is really well taken, that a lot of Arab governments, especially when we've been seeing increasing normalization and peace treaties between Israel and Arab states, Arab governments are not representing their people in many cases. I think the eruption of anger last night is a message to Arab governments. And I think, you know, the scale of this incident, the hospital, I think was very, very difficult for Arab and regional governments to ignore. I spoke with Hussein Ibish. He is a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. And he made a point about how Biden's visit could still be a win domestically.
Biden's trip was a good idea politically. There's a lot of support in the United States for Israel, and it's going to be well received in the United States. But from a policy point of view, it was disastrous. Even though he could not have anticipated the explosion at the hospital, and he has made the policy faux pas of siding with Israel when circumstances are not yet clear. But from a political point of view, I think it still does work for him. The anger in the Arab world, in Lebanon, etc., is inevitable. The United States has made a great show of siding with Israel. And Lebanon is a very good example of the part of the Arab world which would be most incensed, because there are lots of Palestinians there, lots of Hezbollah supporters who side with Palestinians, lots of other people who are very sympathetic to Palestinians, and many Lebanese who have felt the same experiences at the hands of Israel and others, but specifically at the hands of Israel, that the Gazan people are going through right now.
President Biden is on a plane home. As to what next, I mean, what is your sense, Rebecca, of where things are headed in the coming days? Did your encounters with protesters give you any better understanding of what comes next?
I mean, again, we have seen protests several times over the last 10 days since this war between Israel and Hamas started. Today, of course, were the largest and I think the most explosive protests we've seen, especially because they were at the U.S. Embassy and there was so much tear gas used and the Lebanese police and army were there to try to push protesters back. But I definitely think this is not the end of the protests here in Lebanon and this will not be the end of the protests in the region either, Marco.
Journalist Rebecca Collard reporting for The World from Beirut. Rebecca, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Ahead later this hour, the effort to investigate that hospital explosion in Gaza and the urgency to verify who was responsible. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The next president of Argentina could be a candidate who admires Donald Trump, wants to dollarize the economy, and legalize the sale of guns. Libertarian economist Javier Milei is leading the polls ahead of Sunday's national election. The World's TBC Isaiah tells us more about this man and why he's so popular in Argentina.
Javier Milei is not your average presidential candidate.
Hola a todos! Yo soy el león!
Hello, everyone. I am the lion, he said in a recent campaign rally.
Soy el rey, te devoraré. Toda la casta es de mi apetito.
I am the king, and I will devour all of them, he continued singing. By all of them, he's referring to Argentine politicians, especially socialists.
O sea, porque ¿qué es en el fondo un socialista? Es una basura, es excremento humano.
Socialists are trash, human excrement, he said. This wild-haired celebrity economist has made a lot more contentious statements in recent years, like humans didn't cause climate change or people should be able to sell their organs.
Mi primer propiedad es mi cuerpo. ¿Por qué no voy a poder disponer de mi cuerpo?
My first property is my body, he said in a radio interview. I should be able to do whatever I want with it. But he remains a strong opponent of abortion. Milei has insulted his compatriot Pope Francis several times, despite identifying, like most Argentines, as Catholic.
El Papa, sí, lo voy a decir de frente, es el representante del maligno en la tierra.
The Pope is the representative of evil on earth because he supports social justice, he said. Milei also promised to radically cut public spending. In a widely shared video, he said he would eliminate more than half of the public ministries if he becomes the next president.
Ministerio de Trabajo, Empleo y Seguridad Social, afuera. Ministerio de Educación, adoctrinamiento, afuera.
Ministry of Labor, out. Ministry of Education, out. Ministry of Health, out. The list goes on and on. His most popular proposal is to abolish Argentina's central bank and adopt the US dollar.
I think part of his appeal comes from his promise to reverse more than two decades now of pro-state policies.
That's Bruno Binetti, an Argentine political scientist with the Inter-American Dialogue. He says many Argentines are frustrated with disastrous economic policies, including overspending, which has led to triple-digit inflation.
A lot of people, particularly poor people, of course, and lower middle classes, they feel that whoever promises to detonate everything and start again, that's something they're willing to explore because they feel they have nothing to lose.
That's what I heard when I talked to residents of Villa Fiorito, a poor suburb close to Buenos Aires, the capital.
Porque la gente tiene mucha bronca. La gente no puede comprar un paquete de azúcar, un paquete de harina.
Pastor Leonardo Álvarez says people here are angry because they can't afford to buy basic food and prices rise every week. He says Milei is also angry, so they identify with him. Journalist Juan Luis González wrote a book about Milei, which takes his nickname as its title, El Loco, or The Madman.
Este contexto, un hombre solitario, una vida muy difícil, él sufrió violencia en la casa de chico, el padre lo golpeaba mucho.
In the book, González portrays Milei as a loner who was bullied and beaten as a child.
Una vida muy difícil que lo lleva a convencerse que el perro no es el perro, sino es el hijo.
González says Milei is convinced that his dog, who died recently, was his son.
Entonces, cuando el perro muere, por un lado lo hace clonar en Estados Unidos. Está años ahorrando, porque cara la operación sale $50,000.
When his dog died, he paid $50,000 to clone it, González found out. And Milei started talking with a medium to communicate with his dog. In fact, in his public speeches, Milei frequently thanks the advice of his four dogs, who are named after libertarian economists.
También deseo darle las gracias a mis hijitos de cuatro patas, a Conan, a Murray, a Milton, a Robert y a Lucas.
Juan Luis González, the biographer, says more than Milei's ideas, what worries him most is his state of mind and emotional stability.
El más preocupante para mí es la estabilidad emocional de Milei, el tema de la salud mental que no está bien Milei.
He's also worried about his fanaticism toward free market policies. Argentina's voters will decide on Sunday how serious they are about voting for Javier Milei. Recent polls show him neck to neck with socialist finance Minister Sergio Massa and former Security Minister Patricia Bullrich. Milei remains the favorite, but a second round is likely. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
And now a note from the art world. The Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam announced this week that it will not be handing out Pokemon cards anymore. Buzz about a promotional playing card called Pikachu in Gray Felt Hat has overshadowed the exhibit that it was meant to celebrate. the Pokemon Company had joined forces with the museum for an exhibit exploring Vincent van Gogh's links to Japanese culture. The painter did have a great interest in Japanese printmaking. So artists from Japan adapted treasured Van Gogh works, and Pokemon figures were inserted into paintings, such as Sunflowers, The Bedroom, and Wheat Field with Crows. This ad for the exhibit shows Pokemon characters frolicking through a brightly colored Van Gogh landscape of sunflowers and windmills. It seemed like a fun idea, appealed to art lovers and Pokemon players alike, but opening day did not go well. This was a scene on September 27th. The exhibit doors had just opened. Visitors crowded into the gift shop to buy up Van Gogh-inspired Pokemon merch and to get a free commemorative playing card, Pikachu with gray felt hat, an homage to the famous self-portrait. The crowd, many of them Pokemon card speculators, cleaned out the day's supplies of cards, and within hours, online ads for the cards were posted with asking prices of up to $300 for a single Pikachu card. This did not sit well with Pokemon purists.
Let's talk about some observations that I discovered in the chaos that has ensued at the Van Gogh Museum.
A YouTuber with a handle Goat Breakers spoke for many.
First off, there is not a single child in sight. Second of all, this does not represent the Pokemon community whatsoever.
He advised players and collectors not to buy cards online from speculators. Then yesterday, the Pokemon Company saw an opportunity and they put 10,000 more cards up for sale.
The Pikachu Van Gogh promo just restocked on the Pokemon Center today and prices immediately crashed.
That's a Pokemon pundit who goes by the name Will at Dr. Applesauce 2. He predicts that the market for Pikachu with gray felt hat cards is going to bottom out. As for the artwork, visitors can still check out the exhibit through January 7th at the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam. Just don't expect any freebie Pikachu cards. More news and stories from around the globe are still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. The Oxford English Dictionary holds a special place in the reference section. It goes back to the 19th century, but a more recent discovery sheds new light on how it was written.
I open up this dusty box, and inside was this little black book that I'd never seen before.
Inside, the names of thousands of dictionary people and the words they provided to the OED. That's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The explosion at the Al-Ali Baptist Hospital in Gaza has grabbed attention around the globe. What caused that explosion, which Palestinians say killed hundreds of civilians, is not at all clear. President Biden today said that the U.S. has evidence that a failed rocket launch by the Palestinian militant group, Islamic Jihad, is to blame. Shreds of evidence and lots of speculation favoring one theory or another are all over the internet. Open source investigators are poring over everything they can to get a better picture of what happened. Colina Coltai is a researcher for Bellingcat, which does this kind of thing. They famously unmasked a separatist who shot down flight MH17 over Ukraine with a surface-to-air missile from Russia. So, Colina, with a situation like this in Gaza, how do you start to think about the task of investigating what happened and all the assets you can turn to in that effort?
We have a shared Slack, and I remember seeing the message come in saying, oh my goodness, we think that there's been a bombing at a hospital. Staff members from all across the globe, because we are globally distributed, began to catalog, collect, try to find all pieces of video and images and statements that we can use to try to piece together what's going on. So we go out and start searching across Twitter, now known as X, Instagram, TikTok, Telegram, just to see if we can start piecing together what is truly happening. So I started working on this last night, went to bed, woke up, and there is like hundreds of messages that's happened overnight while I've been sleeping. We've been really working hard together as a team on this. So it's a really big collective effort just trying to piece together what's happening.
I mean, we're all scrolling through these platforms. What are you at Bellingcat looking for specifically?
specifically look for things that are consistent among footage and things that we can identify that are notable in the surrounding area. Some of the initial footage that came out was at night, so it's really dark and makes it much harder. And now that we've gone into day, we have better footage, better images. So we're trying to assess some of the damage, some of the content. We really value being able to like stand behind the content that we analyze. So we try to only share things that we know that we can geolocate from that area and sometimes with sources that we can trust, who have been consistently trustworthy.
Elliot Higgins, the founder of Bellingcat, tweeted a discussion of some of the evidence so far. What evidence does lead to clear conclusions at this point?
Yeah, it's hard to say what is clear and what's not at this moment. Elliot was tweeting out some images that we were finding online that we were able to then geolocate. So we were able to confirm they are from the area near that hospital, looking particularly at the damage that was done.
Kalina, let's talk about some of the things that have been stated publicly. President Biden says Islamic Jihad was behind the blast. How do you think about these kind of statements? Do they factor into your investigation at all?
We certainly take statements from public officials into consideration because sometimes they can point us to certain clues or certain areas that maybe we missed, trust but verify. You know, we have conflicting statements immediately, right, of who was responsible, but we won't confirm that it's true or we don't necessarily back that up until we know we've done our own analysis and our own verification.
I imagine it gets even tougher when you've got officials releasing information like what the Israeli Defense Forces released. They said this, what we're about to hear, is a call they intercepted and recorded, allegedly a conversation between two Hamas operatives. So obviously a little hard to hear, but in the call, one is telling the other, quote, they are saying it belongs to Islamic Jihad. And he goes on to say the shrapnel apparently does not look like Israeli shrapnel. And they think it was from a rocket launched from a cemetery behind the hospital and it fell. Again, all we know is that IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, says that's what this tape is. What do you do with that? Do you add it to the evidence file? Do you treat it with skepticism?
You know, I think we treat every piece of media with some bit of skepticism, especially on an audio file like that, because we weren't the ones who got the file. We don't know its origin. We can take it at its face value. But I think part of the values of the work that we do here is we try to use sources and media from where we know that we can verify its content. So on an audio file, that becomes really difficult because we don't know the origin of that.
What does it feel like, Kalina, taking in all these streams of information and assigning the appropriate weight to the evidence you see?
It can feel really overwhelming. I think anyone who's been looking at this content over the past week probably feels that same way, that there's been so much content and there's been so much mis- and disinformation, so many conflicting statements that it feels, I think, really difficult to wade through what's going on. And even among us, we are here trying to just figure out and parse it together.
This hospital explosion that killed reportedly hundreds of people, I mean, it has the potential to be an inflection point in this already very deadly conflict. Remind us why it matters in the fog of war, why it matters to know what we know and how we know it.
I think it's really important, particularly in cases like the bombing at the hospital, to figure out, you know, who is truly responsible, because it is such an egregious event. It's a war crime. And so there is a lot of pressure and there's a lot of attention on making sure that whoever is responsible for this, the blame is rightly attributed.
Kalina Koltai is a researcher with Bellingcat. Kalina, thank you very much for taking us inside your approach to these really complex issues.
Thank you for having me on.
In the 1970s, the concept of microloans was revolutionary. Small loans that required no collateral, but big enough to help people start a small business and pay back the loan, circumventing loan sharks. The first microlending bank was started by a man named Muhammad Yunus back in the 1970s in his native Bangladesh. The idea caught on and worked so well that Yunus was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. But as more mainstream banks got involved, microfinance began to go horribly wrong. In a moment, we'll hear from Muhammad Yunus himself, but first, let's go to Cambodia, where student journalist Hannah Het reports on how microfinance schemes there have sent people in poverty into even deeper debt.
On the vast floodplains of Tonle Sap, the country's largest lake is slowly receding. The drying shore is cracked with deep lines, but from the muddy waters sprout small green rice shoots. Tractors roar in the background, Kumsri Mom is a farmer here in Battambang Province, known as the Rice Bowl of Cambodia. She has a 10-year-old son and a 5-year-old daughter. Her husband works as a welder. Like many farmers, she's had to rely on credit in order to buy things like fuel, fertilizer, and seeds.
In the past few years, rice farming was profitable. I spent the money to clear the rice fields for farming. I spent it on assembling and repairing machinery. The expenses were high. The difficulties are quite many. But as a rice farmer, I have to keep going.
Cambodia has been especially hard hit by climate change, with increased droughts and floods. And then Russia's invasion of Ukraine caused fuel and fertilizer prices to spike. At the end of last year, Sri Mom owed over $12,000. That's more than 6 times the average Cambodian annual income. She was struggling to make payments. That's when a bank worker showed up at her door.
We were 10 days late to pay them. They said, if we do not have the money for them today, they will put up a sign to sell our land.
She and her family live in a house owned by her mother and use the land title as collateral for one of the loans. This practice has become increasingly common. Nellie Pelorge is the outreach director of the Cambodian League for the Promotion and Defense of Human Rights, also known as the CADO. She has focused on the country's growing debt crisis for years.
Cambodia has a population a little bit over 16 million, 1/6. And it is the most over-indebted country in the world. And a lot of these debts are through these microfinance institutes we call MFIs. And it's one of the few sectors that actually grew during COVID times. It grew by 30%.
The deeper borrowers go into debt, the more they borrow to pay that debt. Pelorge says that eventually they may be driven to sell their land or put their children to work on farms and in factories or leave their homes to look for jobs to repay the loans.
The way that they're conducting their business is predatory. It's a business. It's not for the good. It's not pulling people out of poverty. It's doing the opposite.
Like any other sector, there are always bad stuff where individuals do not stick to their professionalism. However, the sector has zero tolerance policy against those unethical stuff.
That's Kang Tongi. He's the head of the communications department at the Cambodia Microfinance Association, which represents the industry. He says that credit officers are careful to make sure that borrowers can repay the loans.
In Cambodia, when you provide a loan to client, you are legally required to check their credit history and you have to strictly analyze their cash flow or repayment capacity.
Indeed, when microfinance started in Cambodia, it was well regulated, according to Nithya Natarajan. She's a lecturer at King's College London. There are checks and balances on the size of loans, the number of loans given, and tight controls on interest rates, she says. Then, in the early and mid-2000s, it began to change as commercial banks took over the lending programs that non-governmental organizations had run.
Those checks and balances were largely eroded because the commercial push meant that the emphasis was more on expanding the market, trying to reach new consumers all the time. So it kind of went to more poorer and more precarious households.
The government, which is deeply in debt itself, has done little to rein in the lending industry. Natarajan says large international lenders looking for profits are among those to blame.
Microfinance is widely and globally seen as a kind of successful development policy. And so its expansion is usually hailed. And largely the Cambodian government kind of follows that line.
After many complaints, the World Bank's financial arm is investigating the 6 commercial lenders behind most of the loans. A decision isn't expected soon. Meanwhile, farmers who are behind on their loans are still being coerced to sell their lands. And some families who can't pay their debts are pulling their children out of school and sending them to work to pay the loans that once promised to lift them out of poverty. For The World, I'm Hannah Het, Battambang Province, Cambodia.
We wanted to learn more about why, despite early optimism, microfinance, these microloans, failed to lift so many people out of poverty in places like Cambodia. So we reached out to Muhammad Yunus. He's an economist from Bangladesh. Yunus received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006 for his work founding the Grameen Bank and pioneering the concepts of microcredit and microfinance. Professor Yunus, as we heard in that story from reporter Hannah Hetty, microfinance has left many vulnerable people deeper in debt, accumulating more debt to pay off past debt. That's the case in Cambodia and several other countries. When it comes to this basic concept of small loans for low-income people, what do you think went wrong?
It went wrong because many loan sharking practices are also called microcredit. So anything under the sun is called microcredit. So you mentioned some of the programs which went wrong, but there are many programs which are successfully done around the world. And microcredit in Bangladesh is almost a household thing for every family in Bangladesh, in the poor families. Mm. We do it in the United States, Grameen America, which reaches out to nearly 200,000 women, doing it for 14 years, lend out over $1 billion a year now. But it works nearly over 99% and above repayment rate over the last 14 years, despite COVID-19 and everything else.
Well, clearly it is a case that legit microcredit programs have been overtaken in cases by commercial banks that non-governmental organizations had once run. How big of a surprise was that to you?
We were very worried about it. They have taken microfinance to make money for themselves. So their intention is to profit maximization, not helping people. Genuine microcredit is a social business. It's a business to help people rather than make personal profit out of it. So it's a non-dividend business. It's a self-sustaining business, but no owners take any dividend out of it. So when the conventional banks pick it up, obviously they want to make profit. So it's a wrong path.
What is the essential difference between how a true microfinance program works and how a bank operates?
Conventional bank go to the rich, I go to the poor. Conventional bank go to the city center, I go to the remote village. Conventional bank go to the men, I go to women. Conventional bank wants collateral, I said forget about collateral. Conventional banks want lawyers to come into every transaction, I said forget about lawyers. So entire microfinance is lawyer-free banking. Entire microfinance is collateral-free banking. Entire microfinance is saying you have the ability to become an entrepreneur. Here is the money, you start whatever business you want to do.
And what is different about the terms of the loans at the center of the two approaches you just described?
Every loan the microcredit gives has to be income-generating loan. Conventional bank give you money to buy a refrigerator. That's not income-generating. So you get into debt. You want to buy the shoes which you cannot afford because it doesn't give you any income. So that's the most distinguishing feature, that it says you are an entrepreneur. It's all business loans. It is not consumption loans.
In hindsight, I guess we could have predicted the rise of loan sharks stepping in like wolves in sheep's clothing and bringing more debt on low-income people. What would you say you got right, Muhammad Yunus, decades ago about how to end poverty? And what do you wish you had gotten right?
Poverty is not created by poor people. Poverty is created by the system that we built. So no matter how much you put your efforts to solve poverty within the system, you go back to the same old problem of poverty, system creating poverty. I said our machine, the economic machine, is a sort of a sucking machine. It sucks up wealth from the bottom and sends it to the top. And all the top few people have all the wealth of the world. So the people at the bottom remain where they are or slightly improve a little bit. But if you want to create a world free from poverty, we have to redesign the system where it will not pump out all the wealth to the top. It will bring the wealth from the top to the bottom. We need to redesign the financial system, whether you are from poor family, whether you're middle income family, it doesn't matter. You are as capable entrepreneur as anybody else.
One last thing, Muhammad Yunus. In the 1970s, you argue that credit is a human right. Decades later, has the world made any progress on that front? I mean, you believe it, but what about the rest of the world?
This system has created, present system has created into money-making monsters. We are money-making robots. We cannot see anything other than the money. We sniff money, we think money, we sell money. We forgot that there are human beings on this planet. There's an environment of this planet. We destroy everything just to make money. I said, we have to get out of this. Otherwise, we'll destroy ourselves very soon.
Nobel Peace Prize laureate Muhammad Yunus, he's been speaking with us about the promise and frustration of microfinancing. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Before Wikipedia, before the internet, even before TV, radio, or the telephone, there was a crowdsourced platform fueled by information shared by people from around the globe. You know it as the Oxford English Dictionary, the OED. It's mammoth, over 100 pounds and 20,000 pages. It is a definitive guide to the English language. This week, a book about the OED is coming to U.S. bookstores. Sarah Ogilvy is author of The Dictionary People. It tells the story of the scholars, editors, and contributors who created the reference book. She joins us from the home of the OED, Oxford, England. Sarah, before we talk about your new book, give us a description of the Oxford English Dictionary itself.
So the Oxford English Dictionary, which is normally referred to as the OED, it's the largest English dictionary in the world. And when they first started it back in 1858, they thought that it would take 2 years to finish. Then they thought it would take 10 years, and it actually ended up taking 70 years. But right back at the start, what these three men in London who first proposed the dictionary did, they were really smart, and they realized that if they wanted to create a dictionary of every single word in the English language, that a small group of men in London or in Oxford just couldn't do that alone. So they asked people all around the world to read their local books, write out their local words on small pieces of 4x6-inch paper, and send those slips of paper, which are now called slips, into Oxford. And so many people sent in slips to the longest serving editor, whose name was James Murray. So many people sent in slips that Royal Mail had to put a red pillar box right outside his house.
Sarah, in The Dictionary People, your book, you tell a story about a discovery that inspired your research. It begins in a basement of the Oxford University Press. What happened there? What'd you see?
Yes, well, it's actually thanks to America. I was coming over for a new job at Stanford, and my American visa was delayed. And so I went and did my favorite things around Oxford. And one of my favorite places is down in the basement underneath Oxford University Press, which is where the dictionary archive is stored. So I was down there and I open up this dusty box, and inside was this little black book that I'd never seen before. And it was tied with cream ribbon, and I undid the ribbon. And as soon as I opened it, I recognized the immaculate handwriting of that longest serving editor, James Murray. And I realized that these were the names and addresses of all the people around the world who had sent him in slips. And I have basically spent the last 9 years researching all of those people. So we now know that there were 3,000 people. And when I went to my job at Stanford, and I worked with a fantastic group of students, we basically just trawled through censuses and marriage certificates and death certificates and 19th century newspapers. And we found as much information as we could about each of those people.
So contributors to the OED, they did not have email, obviously, in the 19th century. Sarah, how did these 19th century word lovers actually submit the material for the dictionary?
They basically used the penny post and the mail system. They also took advantage of what was the latest technology back then, which was steam power and steam ships. So the steam ships carried these slips across the oceans. And what's kind of one of the revelations of my book is that, in fact, there were far more women who answered this call and who helped the dictionary. And there were far more Americans than we expected.
I'm speaking with Sarah Ogilvy, author of The Dictionary People, which is a fascinating look at the Oxford English Dictionary and its evolution. Your book, Sarah, is really a collection of stories, not a collection of words, and you profile a number of contributors to the OED. Let me ask about another one, Margaret Murray, no relation to the editor, James Murray. We meet her when she is sending slips in from India.
Yes, Margaret started volunteering for the dictionary as a teenager living in Calcutta. And she used to get up early in the morning when it was still cool and go to the top of the house to the roof. And there she would sit and read books from her mother's bookshelf. Most of them were Indian travelers' tales. And she'd write out slips of Indian English words and send them into
Murray, and she did that for about 7 years. She ultimately moves to England and becomes the first female Egyptologist. And her contribution to the dictionary takes a wonderful cycle where she ends up writing and specializing in witchcraft, and her books eventually are read by other volunteers, and words from her books get into the dictionary.
Wow. Is there someone who holds the record for entries into the OED?
Yes, the top contributor sent in 165,000 slips, and he was a Brit called Thomas Austin. But there was also a wonderful woman whom I really admire from the book. Her name is Anna Thorpe Wetherill, and she was an anti-slavery activist in Philadelphia. And she sent in a lot of words to do with her interests. So she sent in the words abhorrent and abolition. My goodness, there are so many extraordinary characters.
The abolitionist who suggested words from the U.S., were abhorrent and abolition not in the OED before that?
Yes. So what you find is because there were so many people sending in words, that Anna's words go into a bundle with other examples of abhorrent and abolition. So a lot of people sent in the same words, but they would have been from different dates and different books. So they all would have contributed to the biography of that word.
So people read books to find words. I mean, the OED still gets words sent to it. Are people reading as much as they used to?
Yes, they are, of course. In fact, they're probably reading more than ever because of social media. And the OED editors are tracking words almost in real time. But you are right. People still send in slips. And the OED just launched a wonderful new website about a month ago, where when you look up a word, there is a contribute button where people can send a direct message to the editor if there's something that they want to add to a particular entry.
I have to ask you, Sarah, in the age of Google, what relevance does the Oxford English Dictionary still have?
The OED has huge relevance today, not so much as a discrete dictionary, but rather as data, as valuable, curated, structured data. Dictionaries are now powering the back end of the internet, and many of the digital tools that are on our devices draw on dictionary data. So the dictionary is definitely alive and well today, and it wouldn't be for all those people back in the 19th century. We just wouldn't have such a quality dictionary had it not been for them.
Sarah Ogilvy is the author of The Dictionary People, The Unsung Heroes Who Created the Oxford English Dictionary, published this week. Great to meet you, Sarah. This was a lot of fun. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Marco.
And our final words, the world comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow.